This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
I'm Annie Burke, and this is New Books in Film. What are you doing right now? I mean, besides listening to this podcast, are you commuting to or from work? Are you doing laundry or making dinner? Are you listening to this to procrastinate your work, or are you listening to this for work? Both. Neither. Why are you listening right now? And when you're done, what are the odds that next you'll pull up some goofy TikToks on your phone? Okay, before I get too meta about this, let me introduce our guest, Madeline Lane McKinley, a lecturer at UC Santa Cruz and author of the book Comedy Against Work, Utopian Longing in Dystopian Times. Dr. Lane McKinley is here to discuss Comedy Against Work, which came out last month. It's November 2022 from Common Notions Press. Madeline, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Can you tell us a little about yourself and how you got into comedy and media scholarship?
Yeah, I mean, there's a long version of every story, so maybe I'll start in the 90s. I was a kind of comedy geek in elementary school who would record things on VHS tapes and then record over those. And I got exposed to a lot of comedy really early on and, you know, was the movie reviewer for my high school newspaper and things like that. And then I went to grad school. I studied literature at University of Chicago, and then I got a PhD at UC Santa Cruz. And I really, you know, comedy was there. Comedy and media scholarship were there the whole time, but I really returned to them after getting my PhD and spending a lot of time kind of reflecting on, you know, why did I study literature all that time, and what was it getting at? What was the purpose of that for me? A lot of that just, you know, post-grad school was inviting myself to apply some of that work to things that I care about and the things that I see other people caring about, including my students and friends and people peripheral to the academy or even kind of against the academy. So I think that's kind of how I, you know, crept around and then returned to this form of scholarship. Yeah.
Well, I mean, comedy nerd and high school newspaper movie critic sound like I feel like I'm like listening into a mirror, looking into a mirror when you say that. And I think, yes, and with comedy, it always seems to start very young, that interest in it. But the examples you give, as we're going to talk about, are all pretty contemporary, or I should say that there's a lot of links to the present, which I imagine was one of the great joys and challenges of writing the book. But yeah. So as you sort of moved into away from sort of literature proper with a capital P into the study of comedy and popular culture, how did this particular project about comedy work, utopias and dystopias, how did this project evolve?
So that theoretical foundation that I got from grad school, you know, included a lot of, you know, careful studying of utopian theory and literature and Marxist feminism and, you know, the Frankfurt School and things like that. And I think all of that kind of seeps into the project. But there was just a period after getting my PhD where I was reflecting on my experiences as a worker in the University of California, and my previous union is currently on strike. So I have to say, you know, solidarity with the strikers, UAW strikers across the UC system. I was in that union for 8 years and know deeply those struggles. And I was thinking about that a lot and thinking a lot about, you know, what it was like to be a parent in grad school. I became a parent in my first year of the PhD program, and the challenges of that and the isolation of that. And I think that just there was a period of reflection that allowed me to kind of reconnect with comedy as not just how I coped and, you know, turned off the clock, which obviously I don't think I really did. That's part of what I'm writing about and through and against in this book, that tension. But it allowed me to kind of think about what I was doing with comedy that whole time and kind of look at comedy as a utopian through line of my whole life, really, that deserved revisiting, but also seemed to speak to a lot of the struggles I was observing as a worker in the university system and living in collective houses and having friends who worked in all sorts of really different and difficult job situations. I think just having a desire to synthesize those experiences, I think, was a lot of where the book came out of.
You write this book. I mean, I love, in many ways, this book is like, if you could pick all the things I want to hear about in a book, your book, like, it has so many wide ranging examples, but everything I wanted to know and think and talk about. So that's one reason I was so excited to have you on the show. And I want to get into the meat of your argument, but I also did want to talk about the sort of personal way that it's written. And I feel like you've led me right there. So maybe we can just talk about that first. That you write, you incorporate your own voice and experiences as a parent, as a teacher, as an academic, talking about sort of like the awkward cocktail party conversation that people have in academia. I'm reminded, I wanted to pull out this passage you have about the stew, and I lost it. I'm sorry. But, oh no, here we go, because I'm looking in the wrong place. So it's about, you talk about, much of this book has been written from my kitchen, mostly at a desk beside a window, but also from the kitchen counter, where I move between paragraphs and chopping vegetables on a butcher block beside the stove, where I every so often dip my wooden spoon into a pot and stir. I've come to understand stew, much like this book, as both parts labors of love and work housework strike, never one without the other. I thought that was great. I wanted to, or our listeners, to hear it. But was that originally, when you conceived of this project, did you know you were going to be in it in a way that many authors don't sort of feature as characters as full people in their monographs. Mm-hmm. Was that something that you knew you wanted to do when you started, or was that something that you realized at some point, I can't write this book without putting myself in it, or it would help to put myself in it?
I think that a lot of what I'm doing in the book is messing around with genre. And so I think that that was important to me. It was also, I have to give credit to my editor, Andy Battle, who read an earlier draft and just thought, you know, these moments where you do appear are good. Keep doing that. Because I think I was having I'll say it this way. Being very much conditioned as an academic and having spent, you know, one year outside of academia in my adult life, which I spent on a Greyhound bus listening to comedy and reading comedy and things like that, you know, as I look back. But I was reconciling with, you know, how discouraged I'd always been from using that personal voice in any academic writing. And the experience I have as a writing and composition teacher of working with students who have been told their whole lives never to use the first person in their writing, and, you know, suddenly with a change of genre, you know, and an invitation to do that, something really unlocks and is, you know, it's a beautiful thing to watch. So I spent a lot of time kind of thinking about that methodologically, but I'm also writing a lot about comedy as a form of feminist writing. And so I think I wanted to take that seriously at a formal level, you know, and not just thematically, right? It seemed really appropriate that I get at that at all levels.
Well, as a reader, it's very rewarding because you sort of get to feel like you're watching the book get made you're reading the book. It's trippy. No, it's in a larger feminist tradition of writing.
Right.
That certainly pays off. But I want to make sure you get a chance to talk about the book itself not necessarily just that you wrote the book and how you wrote it. But I want to talk about comedy and work, obviously.
Well, I'm glad that Stu came up because
we gotta talk about Stu. And thinking about how you're using comedy to cope with, like, to cope or to get through the day, get through the work day, even though it is the work, is, I think, going to resonate with a lot of listeners who are writers, critics, and academics. I have such a hard time because, like, my hobby, my favorite thing to do when I'm not working is to watch movies and TV, and my job is to write and think about movies and TV. And so sometimes I think I have to find something to watch. I'll be like, oh, let's watch this. I'm not going to find anything good or interesting in this. Mm-hmm. So I won't have to turn that part of my brain on. But it's very hard to, like, find something. Not only you're like, I don't want to like this and I don't want to find it interesting. Like, if there's anything even mildly provocative in it, I'm gonna get, like, that's gonna get switched on, and then the workday is back on. So it means purposely watching really vapid things, but that can't even be, like, in a cultural studies way interesting, because you're like, oh no, I'm back, like, watching F Boy Island, but now something is, like, rattling around and I'm thinking about
I totally relate.
So work is, as you know, work is our social totality. That's me quoting you. And you know that, but in case the listener wants to know, the work is our social totality. And you look at examples really very wide ranging, from the TV sitcom in the form of the sitcom, a historic comedy club strike, the genre of the self-help podcast, and many other forms, as you say, forms and genres of comedy and sort of expositions, narrativizations of work. When putting this book together, how did you decide what would and wouldn't count as work when everything is work, but also that's sort of the problem you're trying to address, which is everything is work, but not everything can or should be work?
Yeah, that's such a good question. Well, I want to think about it in terms of anti-work. What is and isn't anti-work? And I think a lot of my project is, I like to joke, I huffed a lot of Frederick Jameson in grad school. It's like permanently in my brain. But his thinking around the utopian impulse is clearly really foundational for me. And like the joke about Frederick Jameson, right, is that he can find utopia in anything. And I'm kind of following that tradition, I think, or I'm looking at anti-work as a utopian impulse that you can find anywhere if you look hard enough, right? And so I was trying in the book at least to balance out some like rather straightforward examples like The Office or the comedy worker strike of 1979 or things like this, but to build towards some examples that are not straightforward and kind of model for the reader a way of reading, a way of thinking about comedy that builds towards a practice of comedy, right? So on the one hand, The Office seems like a really great example because everyone has at least heard of it. But at this point, everyone has seen an Office episode or a meme or something like this. And so it's useful to me to turn to objects like that and to draw out some of the tensions in them. You know, on the one hand, it's a show about the absurd. The American version is especially conflicted, I think, but it's a show about the absurdity of work, paper company in a paperless economy. I mean, it can get more definitional than that. And then it's also about this like romantic vision of the workplace as not just family, but like better than family, right? It's where you want to escape your family to, or like where you can really fall in love and things like that. So having a lot of examples like that, that felt, fairly relatable, seemed important to me, or, explicit about its content and this relationship between work and comedy. But then I was really thinking, you know, the stew example is a good one, about, you know, how does this happen in my kitchen? Right. And how does comedy take place, you know, in my relationship with my partner as we negotiate these moments where like capitalism is like pitting us against each other in this most intimate way? And how do we use comedy more intentionally as a way of relating to each other and, extending care to one another? In, you know, not just to, grease the wheels, right? Like not just to make this unbearable situation more bearable, but to actually kind of inhabit this critical space together and collectively. So I was hoping that, you know, by the end of the book, you kind of have this sense of comedy as, you know, much more than, you know, episodes of the Office or these, you know, various stand-up routines or things like that, and as a kind of way of life or revolutionary practice in some way. So the hope was that the examples kind of broke apart and had that possibility. That makes sense.
Yes, and you talk about this comedy as a practice. I want to pull out another phrase or I should say, like passage, that you talk about how comedy is a practice of refusal, a mode of critique, and a place to begin imagining and enacting a life against work. So thinking about comedy as an anti-work practice, as an anti-capitalist potentially practice, but that it is also, as you talk about, it's a very fraught relationship because comedy is an industry. It's also used to cope so that people can further continue in their work or can sort of just live alongside capitalism or live inside it. So I guess when you think about like these different exhibits that you draw in as anti-work comedies, like where do you feel like was an example of one that truly delivered on this practice of refusal? And where is one that maybe is just kind of like a deference, a deferral, a kind of like more of a coping mechanism than an actual treatment of the of the problem?
Yeah. So,
or is that, are they all kind of somewhere on the spectrum of like totally fixing it? Obviously, nothing really totally fixes it versus like completely a bait and switch.
Yeah. So I think it is something like a spectrum, right? I don't think that there is a perfect, you know, representation that unlocks these contradictions, but there are better and worse comedies against work, right? So I would say, like, on that spectrum, something like The Office is actually really problematic because of the ways in which it appears to us as anti-work comedy, right? And in fact is all about kind of upholding this capitalist work ethic and romanticizing it. I mean, I don't think there's anything more dystopian than the fact that elementary school children love The Office, right? That The Office was the most popular streaming series of the pandemic, right? When people are getting out of these workplaces, that's exactly when this, I mean, it's not as if it wasn't popular before, but it was more popular in 2020 and 2021 than when it was on the air by far, right? So the idea that there's this period where we're breaking away from work and the stronghold of work potentially, right? Where we can start to trouble that relationship. And that's exactly when that particular series is invited into our living rooms is, you know, it's terrifying. And I would say, yeah, very much on the kind of reactionary end of that spectrum. I look at, maybe I'll answer that within genre first, which is like, I think that the show Abbott Elementary, which I didn't get a chance to write about because it came out so recently, is inhabiting the same genre of the mockumentary sitcom, but its orientation towards work is really different. And I think much more complex in that it's following these teachers whose day-to-day kind of conflicts are all about how to grapple with this idea of a labor of love, right? Like how much their heart is involved in their work and how much care is demanded of them for these children who have, you know, often have no other options. I think it's a really, you know, beautiful re-rendering of that particular genre. So that's just my answer within that genre. But then, you know, I look at Maria Bamford's stand-up comedy as being really, and she's kind of the end point of my book as well, as being a kind of transcendent anti-work comedy that, you know, provides a kind of methodological understanding of what that means, right? That comedy is a way of estranging us from our relationship from work, even in brief moments, and giving us kind of glimpses into what a life against work might be, right? So I think I try to mix enough positive examples of what that looks like, but in each of them, it's, you know, it's, there's contradictions, there's problems, and the best anti-work comedy actually is just about showing us what those problems are so that we can kind of lay them bare and think about them instead of masquerading work as something that it isn't, which, you know, a lot of these sitcoms end up doing, right, is kind of disciplining us as workers more than providing us that release valve that we really want from it.
Right, because anti-work comedy isn't necessarily about, like,
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Saying that you're not going to work anymore. It's about showing the problems of work. And I think showing the work of work, that mm-hmm. it's hard, because even when you're when you're picturing a life without work, or a life where you're taking a break from work, it doesn't mean that it's not all like, you know, cucumbers on your eyes.
right.
Restful. It can be like the life of like working communally towards something
mm-hmm.
or family and friend relationships. It doesn't mean that you're like completely retreating from your responsibility to other people. It just means that maybe you're not doing it in the structure of the work of like a capitalist workplace or a place that extracts value, maybe without putting anything back, which I think mm-hmm. You see really laid bare when you look at the labor of comedy. Mm-hmm. And when you talk about the 1979 comedy strike, one of the things that I think connects like comedians and academics is this idea of, if you love what you do, you're not really working, so we're not going to pay you.
Absolutely.
Once you start hating it, we'll pay you more. And it's like, well, I'm there. Like, if I hated it, if I'm, you know, maybe I hate that I'm not being paid, can that get me more payment? I think that, and so you talk a lot, particularly, and I'd say like the first half of the book is a lot about the labor of making comedy.
Mm-hmm.
And you talk about this tension between what you call jokesterism and the feminist or comedy killjoy, which you attribute to Sarah Ahmed.
Mm-hmm.
But can you talk a little bit about that distinction between jokesterism and the killjoy? Because I think that is been, I feel like, boy, that comes up, that's been coming up a lot lately. but I can't determine a start point.
Absolutely.
I don't want it to be 2016, but it's not, mm-hmm. you know, this idea of jokesterism and sort of operating in, I don't want to say bad faith, but I think that these positions of like, it's the comedian doing the work of being a jokester, or being potentially the critic, or comedian being a killjoy.
Mm-hmm.
But it is also about like the cultural work that these figures do.
Yeah. So let's see. Well, the jokester I draw from Lauren Berlant, who wrote this great New Inquiry essay, kind of at the height of Me Too, looking at a lot of it is kind of actually, it seems inspired by the Al Franken incident, but feels like a great framework for thinking about some of the broader tendencies of that moment and how they, I mean, fold into the present. The jokester figure is kind of based in a Hobbesian theory of comedy as pure domination. The jokester uses comedy to exert his power. And I write about specifically kind of jokester managerialism, like the jokester boss figure who uses, and I don't want to just talk about The Office, but it's reminiscent of the David Brent character, the boss in the UK version of The Office, Ricky Gervais, who calls himself a chilled out entertainer. And he, you know, why aren't his workers more grateful that they have this chilled out entertainer boss who, you know, sexually harasses them and makes fun of their weight and like, makes all these like really disturbing jokes and creates a toxic environment around him, but all under the guise of just joking, right? And so I'm kind of following that from this, you know, much more straightforward figure of the jokester boss, the jokester authoritarian, and thinking about it more broadly as a kind of fascist tendency that we're seeing in comedy right now, and exactly why like the alt-right has claimed comedy as safe ground for itself. And so that's a kind of method of comedy or a practice of comedy that I'm looking at, and I counterpose it to the Killjoy. So the story goes that feminism is antithetical to comedy, that feminism, at least according to Louis C.K., right? Feminism and comedy are the ultimate enemies. And that was very much the story of comedy that I grew up with and that I think is familiar to most people. The idea that once you start critiquing or unpacking comedy, you know, even if we're not talking about feminists doing this, that you're somehow betraying the comedy, right? That you're not supposed to analyze it or think about it, or, you know, dissect the frog, so to speak. So I'm kind of contesting that and thinking about, you know, Killjoys as, you know, being hilarious first and foremost. All the Killjoys that I know are really funny and are funny through analysis and critique. And it's inspiring to watch, you know, my best friend Jasmine kind of pick apart, you know, literally any cultural object. You know, she can draw out the jokes and the problems and really go for it. So I've known that my whole life, even though I've been told this thing about feminism being unfunny, right? But I'm thinking about these as kind of competing practices of comedy. One that is about domination and violence and the assertion of power, and the other that's kind of a collective refusal and that's more oriented towards healing practice. I always tend to use this metaphor about, like, you know, drawing pus out of the wound, right? Like, I think that's what the Killjoy is doing. And that there's like there are actually people who are fascinated by that visually and experientially, but that's, I think, one of the things that you're doing when you're acting as Killjoy. So I think that those are really helpful frameworks for thinking about comedic practices and how they relate to power specifically, which is really like at the heart of what I'm talking about with comedy against work, right? Is like how to create a kind of anti-authoritarian, collective, revolutionary, communist comedy. Mm-hmm. And I start really with that vision of Killjoy comedy.
I mean, I think one thing that sticks out in that distinction for me too is that the idea that being the Killjoy, sort of like standing back and like critiquing, is less brave than being the comedian standing alone in the spotlight. Mm-hmm. doesn't really pan out, and in particular when you're looking at the jokester, because there's this toxic thread of plausible deniability in the jokester figure that they can always just say they were joking.
Right.
And so no matter how far they go, they can always retreat back into just joking. And then as you talk about this kind of like reverse narrative of like, I'm being bullied, I'm being picked on.
Exactly.
And I was just joking. Whereas the Killjoy, who is like ostensibly safe from their like little, you know, critical perch or something, mm-hmm. Is the one who's actually saying something that they can't take back, that they're not working from a place of plausible deniability and, you know, mm-hmm. multivocal, deceptive language that allows them to, like, you know, I'm not going to say the bad thing. You think the bad thing. I'm just going to lead you there. Mm-hmm. There's a kind of, there's more sort of confidence and bravery in that moment, regardless of who I think is being funnier. Like this question of if comedy speaks truth, mm-hmm. like who's actually willing to say it and not say it in a way that they can sort of deny it later. And I wonder how much that maps onto your discussion about authenticity, mm-hmm. And who gets to be authentic in this space of comedy, and who's like, who have we decided are like the authentic comedy workers versus, and mm-hmm. what sort of like, what spaces are left for female authenticity, or how is female authenticity recognized in a different way? Maria Bamford being obviously sort of an example of, I think, a woman comedian who's taking authenticity away from men like Louis C.K. I mean, like, you think you're authentic, like, you're not. And now watch me.
Absolutely. Yeah, well, I look at authenticity, as a kind of weapon of, of this kind. It's within this genealogy of the jokester, right? Of a particular work ethic ascribed to white men in comedy that they can inhabit comfortably or ascribe to themselves. They're often called very brave comedians, just to riff off that bravery.
Men are brave when they do stand up, and women are brave when they are above a size 4 and pose in a bathing suit. Like, that's who gets to be brave. Like, those are
absolutely
very gendered ideas of courage.
For
under
sure.
Fire.
Yeah. And so I look at it that way. Is this work ethic that enables abuse in workplaces and things like this, right? So Louis C.K. is a great example of it, that, you know, his kind of toxic energy. I mean, he was even before we knew the extent of the kind of behind the scenes harassment that he was engaging in, you know, propagating in the comedy industry, on stage, he was, you know, simulating masturbation onto the audience frequently and kind of exhibiting this behavior. And that was authentic, right? That was his being vulnerable. And so he can use that as a kind of power, whereas we look at someone like Cameron Esposito, who did a great special called Rape Jokes in 2019. I think it's a great imminent critique of the comedy industry, but she's very much putting herself in a position of vulnerability because the second that a femme comedian becomes quote unquote authentic, they're unfunny, right? It's the trappings of the killjoy. So it's very much a way of kind of masking these power dynamics that are taking place in comedy. And it's a way of romanticizing the work ethic of, you know, vastly white men. And one of the things I think a lot about with this, and I write about in the book, is, for instance, Andy Kaufman, who's his kind of shtick was to be anti-authentic, right, at the same time. But he was still mobilizing all of these tropes of authenticity and doing it to such an extent that it kind of legitimated abusive behavior, or, you know, drew a question mark around it. So when he was wrestling women, right, he was so quote unquote committed to that, that still people are kind of wondering, you know, was he making fun of himself and not the women he was wrestling? Was he like, was that a kind of weirdly like feminist move on his part, or was it always kind of keeping bringing the women he was wrestling in as the butt of the joke too, right? Was it like actually really deeply anti-feminist? I think those questions come up because authenticity has this, it becomes a kind of move that his comedy was making, where you're always kind of guessing. And it also masks work and workplaces in under a kind of guise of masculine artistry, right? So there's a long history, and I bring in, you know, the history of method actors into this. Their commitment to this, like their authentic commitment to these parts, is celebrated. But if we look at any of the workplaces that these actors were inhabiting, like it's despicable. You know, probably the worst example is, you know, Marlon Brando in Last Tango in Paris, like deciding, I regret that I'm forgetting his co-star's name, but, you know, deciding on her behalf that he should rape her with a butter stick, right? And his decision was coming from this kind of method place, but she, her consent was not required for that decision, right? Because of this gendered aspect of who does and doesn't get to be authentic in these workplaces. So I'm kind of thinking through this as like any of these categories, it's not just about comedy, but it's about how they kind of bleed into other workplaces and you know, help, you know, think about analogies. And I do look a lot at creative workplaces as being particularly ripe for this like toxic energy to come into them. But I don't think that, I think the analogy to the Academy is a really important one. In the book, for instance, I don't think it's specific to the culture industry at all.
Well, I also, before we, I'm looking at the clock, before we close up, I want to think a little bit more about how wildly contemporary this book is, how often you see things. I'm sure that when you were working on this, it felt like, I'm thinking of like the movie They Live, you put on the glasses and like you see, I don't know, that's maybe a weird example of like just the idea that looking around, people can go look up They Live if they feel John Carpenter, but like putting on the glasses and you suddenly see the world like completely differently, or all through sort of your, this particular ideological lens. When you were working on this book, I imagine that you found examples in support of this, of these sort of, this argument about comedy and anti-work everywhere, because comedy is so saturated, like we are so saturated with comedy from everywhere. And of course, we're all working all the time. Mm-hmm. And if we're not working, we're thinking about why we should be working, or we're trying to devise a life with, you know, inject eye roll here, work-life balance, all of that stuff. So what was it like working on something so contemporary? I ask this because I think a lot of scholars and listeners have have projects with sort of a particular end date, and it allows them to, you know, all of this stuff that your entire book might be like, and in conclusion, still happens. but you were probably taking in new input all the time, but eventually you have to finish writing a book. Mm-hmm. So how did you like, how did it feel working in this vein? And is there any, you mentioned Abbott Elementary, but I'm curious about like, even now, do you see things and you think that could go in the book or that could have been in the book?
Yeah. So it's a lot like grasping at sand, and I am constantly thinking about new things I could incorporate into this. But I think that's part of the point, is I wanted to, I'm anti-completist. I'm not trying to show you everything anti-work comedy in this book. I'm trying to elaborate a kind of framework or a way of thinking about comedy that readers can then go on to apply to, you know, whatever is the hot topic of that week or something like that, right? And There was always a temptation to add more. I probably drove my editors crazy in the last stages where I was like, well, I want to put this footnote, please. Like, there's this more recent thing that just happened that really, you know, distills this point. But ultimately, it really is about just setting up a way of thinking about comedy so that it can be useful, so that it has a future. I do write about, I think the earliest stuff that I'm writing about is like Mom's Mabley and vaudeville and things like that. And then I go up to the present, but I rewrote the book basically. It was an earlier book before COVID, but then I kind of decided that, you know, while on the one hand, this is something that I think can be applied to different periods and is working towards a kind of epistemology that I think is useful elsewhere, it's also really just trying to capture this moment of 2020 to 2021, 2022, when I think, you know, a lot of these questions were becoming legible in beautiful ways. And I just wanted to kind of speak to that moment. And I was grappling with the irony of, okay, I have this work project. It's about anti-work, right? What you were saying earlier about trying to find like F-Boy Island or something like this, for trying to find things that
there's
were not.
There's so many interesting things about F-Boy Island, though. I was like, exactly. Oh, foiled again.
Damn.
It's either that show is smarter than anyone thinks, or I'm smarter than I ever thought, because I'll be like, there's my take, but I haven't yet. I want to keep it for myself. It's a little island of stupid pleasures.
It's the life of a cultural critic, though, right?
Yeah.
Like, you just can't turn it off. And what I had been thinking was, you know, this way of escaping from work ended up becoming the site of work for me. And I had terrible insomnia during the first year of the pandemic, and would wake up at 1 or 2 in the morning and come down to my kitchen and just work on this project. And it was, in a lot of ways, how I dealt with what was going on, how I kind of organized my thoughts around what was going on in this chaotic moment. And it was also just a time when I needed to heal from a lot of things. And I found the process of writing about it really pretty healing in surprising ways. So I think that as far as I understand from those who I've, you know, shared the book with, it does seem that like these last couple of years, a lot of things opened up in our imaginations. And I hope that the book really speaks to that, to readers who've given a chance.
I think it will. I think it's a really enlightening and potentially a very healing read for a lot of people who are trying to, you know, devise a meaningful life like that has work in it, but maybe can still be anti-work at the same time. And so I just want to thank you so much for being here. And I want to just give you an opportunity now to draw any attention to any other book-related events you may be doing, any future projects or pieces you would like listeners to be aware of.
Thank you. Yeah. Sure. I am the editor or co-editor, excuse me, of Blind Field, a journal of cultural inquiry, which is a very kind of lo-fi DIY counter-institution. And we put up essays about contemporary culture maybe once a month, a couple times a month at this point. But I always appreciate supporters of that project and for keeping it alive. And it's been a nice kind of autonomous space for myself and my co-editor, Joanna Isaacson, who also wrote a book called Stepford Wives, just came out through Common Notion Press. So I want to plug that for it too. And then, yeah, I've just been finishing up an epistolary novella, actually, with my friend Max Fox called Fag Hag. And that's what I've been working on and wanting to find a home for next. But that's really all I have in terms of promotion. I'm going to be bringing the book on tour at some point, but it's hard to say right now with disease and, you know, I'm just trying to figure out what that looks like. So
I know the pandemic's over unless you go anywhere, and then you're like, oh, the pandemic is still exists. So that's plenty. That's more than enough you have on your work plate. So thank you for sharing it with us.
Thank you.
And for putting in an extra mention for your journal. And again, thank you so much, Madeline, for joining us today.
Thanks,
You've been listening to Madeline Lane McKinley on her book, Comedy Against Work. I'm Annie Burke, and this is New Books in Film.